DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show that takes the most expansive and consequential careers in modern history and extracts the essential policy insights you need to know.
Today, we're attempting to map the incredible life and legacy of George P. Shultz, a man who lived a century from 1920 to 2021.
And Shultz is one of those figures who operated at the absolute highest level of government for decades.
Yeah.
I mean, he influenced everything from the international exchange rate you rely on every day to the strategic framework that basically guided the end of the Cold War.
That's right. And yet, for all that enormous impact, he remains, well, maybe one of the most under-examined statesmen of the entire post-war era.
I think the reason he's often overlooked is precisely because the breadth of his influence is just so staggering. He wasn't simply a political operative.
No, not at all. He was a serious economist, a corporate titan, and a world-class diplomat. He worked under two vastly different Republican presidents, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan.
And if you want a single metric, just one number to understand his unique stature, it's the number 4.
Exactly. George Shultz is one of only two people in U.S. history to have held 4 different cabinet-level posts. The other was Elliot Richardson.
And that speaks not just to longevity in Washington, but to a depth of policy knowledge that just effortlessly crosses traditional boundaries.
It does. He mastered labor negotiation, federal budgeting, global finance, and of course, high-stakes foreign policy.
So that is the core mission for this deep dive. We are unpacking the sources that cover the entire arc of his life. We're going to examine how his academic beliefs, specifically his devotion to the Chicago School of Economics, drove massive governmental actions.
Actions like, you know, the total overhaul of the global financial system under Nixon. Then we'll look at his pivotal 6.5 years as Secretary of State, engineering the Soviet thaw under Reagan.
And we have to conclude by addressing the profoundly contradictory chapters of his later years.
We do. His emergence as a kind of progressive, conservative iconoclast, advocating for a carbon tax and drug reform, juxtaposed with the embarrassing, deeply personal, and ultimately damaging role he played in the notorious Theranos scandal.
A scandal that pitted him against his own family.
Right.
Exactly. When we are done here, you will walk away with a clear understanding of the monumental global shifts he engineered and the moral complexities that even the most trusted statesmen face. You'll understand why a man of such profound historical significance can still be susceptible to a Silicon Valley fraud. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
To understand the policy giant, we have to start with the discipline foundations. Shultz was born in New York City in 1920, grew up in Englewood, New Jersey.
And the source material is very specific here, clarifying a common misconception. He was not related to the wealthy Pratt families, you know, the one associated with Standard Oil.
So he was a self-made academic.
Entirely. That's a really important distinction because Shultz's identity was forged through rigorous intellectual discipline and military service, not inherited privilege. He was a dedicated student, graduating cum laude from Princeton in 1942.
With a Bachelor of Science in Economics.
Yes, and his senior thesis already pointed toward his future career.
The focus on the agricultural program of the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA.
Exactly. So this wasn't just abstract theory for him. It was applied economics, public administration. He was studying how massive government infrastructure and regulatory programs actually impacted local economies and, you know, rural life.
It shows he was always concerned with the practical consequences of policy.
Always. And his education was immediately followed by active duty during World War II. A period that instilled a kind of structured discipline he carried into every single role he had later.
He served in the U.S. Marine Corps from 42 to 45.
Mm-hmm. And he ultimately rose to the rank of captain.
And this wasn't stateside duty. This was serious combat.
Oh, absolutely not. He was an artillery officer attached to the U.S. Army's 81st Infantry Division during the really intense Battle of Angar.
Which was part of the larger, brutal Battle of Peleliu in the Palau Islands.
It was. And when we discuss his later negotiating tactics against the Soviet Union, knowing he has this firsthand combat experience, it just gives a certain gravity to his diplomatic positions.
He really understood the stakes. He knew what conflict meant and, by extension, the value of peace.
After the war, he returned to high-level academics, earning his PhD in industrial economics from MIT in 1949.
He taught at MIT until 1957. But even during this period, the call of public service was already there.
It was. In 1955, he took a leave of absence to serve as a senior staff economist on President Dwight D. Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisers.
Then we get to what many people call the Chicago Connection. And for those who study his career, this might be the single most crucial period in defining his entire ideology.
Absolutely. It's fundamental. In 1957, Schultz moved to the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business. He quickly became a professor there and then served as its dean from 1962 to 1968.
And the timing here is critical. This was the ideological epicenter of the Chicago School of Economics.
It was intellectual ground zero. And the sources confirm he was profoundly influenced by the heavy hitters of that movement.
Particularly Nobel laureates Milton Friedman and George Stigler.
Right.
So what did that influence fundamentally mean for his worldview?
Well, it wasn't just a political affiliation for him. It was a foundational intellectual framework. It was built on efficiency and a deep, deep skepticism of centralized power.
Friedman and Stigler championed monetarism.
Right. The idea that control of the money supply is the most important lever for economic stability. And they fiercely believed in radical transparency and the importance of allowing market forces to determine outcomes with as little government interference as possible.
So when Schultz went to Washington, he wasn't just another appointee. He was an intellectual missionary.
Precisely. This core conviction meant that when he faced labor strikes, budget crises, or international financial chaos, his default setting was always to look for the most efficient market-based solution.
He believed that subsidies, price controls, fixed exchange rates,
all forms of heavy state intervention, he saw them as inherently inefficient and often counterproductive. This belief, crystallized in Chicago, would shape his entire governmental career. And most famously, when he oversaw the dismantling of the entire post-war global financial architecture.
Okay, so Schultz's rapid ascent to that quadruple cabinet status begins in 1969. He accepts President Richard Nixon's offer to leave academia.
And his entry point was as Secretary of Labor, a post he held from 1969 to 1970.
This was his first taste of cabinet-level power, and he immediately had to face a massive challenge.
A huge one. The Longshoremen's Union strike, which was crippling major ports across the country. This was a textbook opportunity to apply his academic theory to a real-world, high-stakes crisis.
Previous administrations, like Johnson's, had often resorted to the federal government's heaviest hand, the Taft-Hartley injunction.
Right, which for our listeners, that's something that forces a mandatory 80-day cooling-off period. It essentially just delays the inevitable while the government mediates.
But that injunction had expired. So the political expectation, and certainly the media anticipation, was for Nixon to intervene dramatically.
But Schultz did the exact opposite. He applied his Chicago school theory.
He believed that federal intervention actually prolonged disputes.
He did. He thought that if the government stepped in, neither side had sufficient incentive to make the painful concessions they needed to make. So the sources note he deliberately chose to just let the negotiating parties work it out, and he endured the short-term political pain.
And the anecdote confirms that this non-interventionist approach actually resolved the crisis pretty quickly.
It did. It seems almost counterintuitive. You know, letting the strike run its course actually expedited the settlement. It really validated his theory that allowing labor and management to find their own painful equilibrium is often faster and more efficient than federal mediation.
However, his tenure as labor secretary immediately presents this profound paradox, a major moment of tension in his free market career.
Yes. We're talking about the Philadelphia plan.
And this policy was decidedly not hands-off. It remains a deeply significant and, I think, controversial moment in the history of labor and civil rights enforcement.
It really does. What exactly did the Philadelphia plan require? It was a direct federal mandate.
The plan imposed specific requirements on construction unions in Pennsylvania.
Unions which had historically demonstrated severe discriminatory practices against black workers. It required federal contractors to set specific goals and timetables for minority hiring, enforced by a deadline.
And the sources stress this point. This marked the first use of racial quotas or set-asides by the federal government.
The very first.
So this is a huge intellectual contradiction for Schultz, isn't it?
It is. The same man who believed in minimal government intervention used the maximum federal mandate to enforce integration and correct historical discrimination. How do you reconcile that?
Well, it highlights the political reality he was operating in.
I think so. He was committed to efficiency, but he was also in the Nixon administration, which, despite its Southern strategy, was committed to...
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying D.C. politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Finding ways to enforce civil rights compliance without massive legislative fights.
And Schultz saw entrenched union discrimination as a market failure.
Exactly. A restriction on the supply of labor. So by imposing the plan, he was using federal power to force the opening of a closed market, aligning civil rights goals with a kind of forced labor market efficiency. It was a significant, if controversial, policy tool that really opened the door for many later affirmative action programs.
After his time at labor, Schultz shifted entirely to economic management, which just shows his exceptional range.
It does. From 1970 to 1972, he took on his second post as the first director of the newly renamed and reorganized Office of Management and Budget, the OMB.
And this formalized the budgetary process within the executive branch, centralizing financial power right under the president.
Then, in 1972, he moved into his third post, Secretary of the Treasury, where he served until 1974.
And his time there was marked by presiding over, well, one failure and one epoch-defining success, both stemming from Nixon's new economic policy.
That's a good way to put it. Domestically, he oversaw the lifting of the price and wage controls that Nixon had initiated earlier.
And what was the outcome of his attempt to restore the free market there?
It was, as the sources clearly indicate, a catastrophic failure.
Really?
Yes. Schultz, driven by his free market belief, thought removing the controls would allow prices to normalize quickly. Instead, the sudden release of all this pent-up inflationary pressure resulted in a massive surge in prices.
So the domestic economic situation just spiraled.
It did. It led to such high inflation that the government was forced to reestablish price freezes just 5 months later. It just goes to show you that brutal political reality, you know, intellectual conviction, doesn't always defeat immediate economic pressures like stagflation.
But the truly global and lasting shift happened in the international arena, relating to the dollar crisis.
Right. This is where Schultz really solidifies his place as a figure who fundamentally reshaped global financial governance.
This cannot be overstated.
No, it can't. Schultz was instrumental in formally abolishing the post-war global financial architecture, the Bretton Woods system. To understand this, we need to talk about the 1971 Nixon shock.
Okay, let's unpack that. Before 1971, under Bretton Woods, major world currencies were pegged to the U.S. dollar, which in turn was directly convertible to gold at a fixed rate of $35 an ounce. It provided stability, but what was the fatal flaw?
Well, the fatal flaw was what's called the Triffin dilemma. For the U.S. dollar to remain the global reserve currency, the U.S. had to supply the world with enough dollars for trade and growth.
But the more dollars we issued,
the less confidence the world had that we could actually redeem all those dollars for gold. We were running huge trade deficits fueled by Vietnam War spending and domestic social programs just flooding the market with dollars. Confidence was collapsing.
So when Nixon unilaterally decided in August 1971 to suspend the direct convertibility of the dollar to gold, the Nixon shock, it was a desperate measure.
A desperate measure to protect our remaining gold reserves. And Schultz, alongside the future Federal Reserve Chair Paul Volcker, supported this bold unilateral move.
It effectively ended the gold standard.
It did, but the global financial community was left in total chaos, trying to piece together a new system. Schultz was the one who presided over the formal abolition of the entire Bretton Woods system in 1973 at an international monetary conference in Paris.
What was the consequence of that official abolition? I mean, if the old system was fixed, what was the new system Schultz ushered in?
He ushered in the era of floating currencies. When Schultz declared the system formally dead, all major currencies were allowed to float. Their value was no longer tied to the dollar or gold, but instead determined by supply and demand in foreign exchange markets.
The ultimate Chicago school victory.
Absolutely. The government stopped trying to fix rates and let the market decide the currency value.
And it permanently shifted the global economy.
It did. It constrained the U.S. less, making it easier to finance deficits. But it also introduced the volatility we now just take for granted. Schultz cemented that free market ideology right onto the global financial system.
And to manage the subsequent turbulence, he played a crucial role in co-founding the Library Group.
Mm-hmm. Which eventually evolved into the G7, institutionalizing regular high-level consultation among the world's major industrial economies. They needed a way to coordinate economic policy to prevent the new floating system from devolving into, you know, currency wars.
It's incredible. He was simultaneously dismantling the financial system built for the early Cold War and establishing the architecture for post-Cold War financial governance.
All while dealing with domestic inflation and sensitive international relations regarding Soviet Jewry.
And then, in 1974, just before Nixon resigned, Shultz briefly left government service. He began an 8-year interlude in the corporate world.
He did. He became an executive vice president and later president and director of the Bechtel Group, a massive engineering and services company.
And this period, from 74 to 82, is crucial. It establishes him as more than just a theoretician. He proved himself as a real operational leader in the private sector.
He really did. Under his leadership, Bechtel received numerous large and very lucrative contracts, particularly from Saudi Arabia.
And the success was measurable.
Very. The sources cite that in the year just before he returned to government service, Bechtel reported a massive 50% increase in revenue.
So this corporate success gave him the stature, the executive confidence, and the practical international experience that he would need for his final and most significant government role.
Exactly.
That ultimate role began in 1982 when President Ronald Reagan selected him as the 60th U.S. Secretary of State, replacing the rather volatile Alexander Haig.
His fourth and final cabinet post.
And the appointment was a massive undertaking. It wasn't seamless.
Not at all. During his confirmation hearings, Shultz faced significant conflict of interest questions because of his recent high-level role at Bechtel and those lucrative international contracts, especially in the Middle East.
So he had to navigate ethical scrutiny related to his business dealings and his transition back to government. It's a theme that, ironically, would reappear decades later with Theranos, just on a much smaller, more embarrassing scale.
It is ironic. And despite the grilling, and he did briefly lose his temper, showing a rare flash of personal heat, he was ultimately confirmed unanimously by the Senate.
What's remarkable about his 6.5-year tenure is the atmosphere he cultivated. He earned deep and unwavering trust from President Reagan.
And he made it a core mission to rely heavily on the career foreign service professionals to formulate and implement policy.
I think that reliance on professionals rather than politicized ideologues is really key to his success. The State Department's official history noted that the Foreign Service gave Shultz its complete support, making him one of the most popular secretaries since the 1950s.
And that strong internal support, his reputation for intellectual rigor and honesty, all of it was absolutely essential because the 1980s were, well, arguably the most dangerous period of the Cold War since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
His 1993 memoir, Turmoil and Triumph, is still one of the most reliable and thorough records of this intense decade.
It is.
So the first diplomatic fire he had to put out immediately involved strained relations within NATO.
Yes, the pipeline crisis in 1982. This is a really serious rift within the alliance.
The Reagan administration had imposed sanctions on the technology needed to complete a gas pipeline being built between West Germany and the Soviet Union.
Right. This was in response to Poland imposing martial law. But the Europeans were furious.
Because the sanctions damaged their economic interests while simultaneously exempting U.S. interests, particularly lucrative grain sales to the Soviets.
It felt like economic unilateralism. It was a mess.
So Shultz had to devise a resolution that satisfied the Allies without abandoning the goal of pressuring Moscow. This required some genuine diplomatic finesse.
And he managed to resolve it by December of 82. He proposed a classic trade-off. The U.S. agreed to abandon the sanctions on the pipeline, conceding the economic point. But the Europeans, in turn, agreed to adopt much stricter controls on strategic trade with the Soviets.
So they traded an immediate economic irritant for greater long-term security cooperation.
Exactly. Preventing technology transfer to the Eastern Bloc. It restored unity just in time for the next big challenge.
Which was the highly controversial intermediate-range nuclear forces deployment,
right.
The INF deployment.
This deployment was perhaps the single most important strategic decision of the early 1980s. NATO was operating under a dual-track decision.
Right. If the Soviets wouldn't remove their existing SS-20 missiles targeting Europe, NATO would proceed with deploying its own cruise and Pershing 6 missiles in European NATO countries.
And the Soviets refused to negotiate seriously. So when deployment began in 1983, it sparked massive anti-nuclear protests all across the continent.
But despite that intense public pressure, Shultz worked tirelessly to maintain Allied unity and the planned schedule. This decision really showed Washington was serious.
It did, and this all happened against a backdrop of truly frightening tension.
It followed Reagan's SDI announcement, the Star Wars program.
The Soviet...
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Shoot down of Korean Airlines flight 007 and the highly realistic Able Archer 83 exercises.
And those exercises, which simulated a nuclear conflict escalation, were so realistic that intelligence sources later confirmed the Soviets genuinely feared a preemptive American attack.
That is the moment of maximum danger. The fear of misunderstanding was palpable.
So how did Shultz push Reagan to move past this peak tension?
Well, Shultz, recognizing the danger of total non-communication, successfully advocated for establishing a personal direct dialogue between President Reagan and the new Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, who came to power in 85.
The strategy was clear. Pressure the Soviets militarily and economically.
The shadow of power, as he called it, but couple that strength with a sincere commitment to engagement.
And the major fruit of this sustained dialogue was the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty.
That treaty was a genuine and monumental Cold War milestone. It eliminated an entire class of nuclear missiles in Europe, a first in disarmament history. Shultz's State Department was instrumental in preparing Reagan for those intense negotiating sessions.
They were able to achieve meaningful de-escalation from a position of renewed strength.
Exactly. And Shultz saw two key events in 1988 that cemented his belief that the changes occurring within the USSR were, in his words, revolutionary and irreversible.
Signaling the true coming end of the Cold War.
The first signal was the Soviet Union's initial withdrawal from Afghanistan. Shultz noted that if the Soviets were willing to leave Afghanistan, they were implicitly breaching the fundamental principle of the Brezhnev Doctrine.
For our listeners, can you remind us what the Brezhnev Doctrine was?
Sure. The doctrine was essentially the Soviet foreign policy principle established after the 1968 invasion of Czechoslovakia. It asserted that the USSR had the right to intervene militarily in any communist state to protect its communist regime.
The never letting go principle of the Eastern Bloc?
Precisely. Afghanistan wasn't strictly a Bloc member, but it was a Soviet client. By allowing them to pull out, Moscow was signaling it would no longer pay any price to enforce its ideological control over allied states.
And the second signal was Gorbachev's proposed major domestic reforms.
Yes, at the 19th Communist Party conference. Things like freedom of speech provisions, competitive elections, judicial independence.
And Shultz, the academic, recognized these structural political changes as profound.
He did. He saw they weren't just tactical. They aimed to reform the fundamental nature of the Soviet state. He correctly analyzed that the USSR was on a path from which it simply could not return.
Now, let's pivot to Latin America. Shultz was known for his very hardline stance against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua.
Oh, very much so. He viewed the Sandinista government as a grave ideological and strategic threat. He called it a very undesirable cancer in the area.
And his foreign policy philosophy here was deeply realist. It often tied back to his market-based concept of power, that diplomacy requires leverage.
Which is perfectly encapsulated in his famous quote about negotiations.
He stated that negotiations are a euphemism for capitulation if the shadow of power is not cast across the bargaining table.
For Shultz, diplomacy without credible strength, whether economic sanctions or military might, was simply weakness being exploited.
And this hardened stance is crucial context for understanding the Iran-Contra affair, where Shultz stood firmly and outspokenly against the White House's illegal actions.
He did. Shultz was one of the few high-ranking officials to openly oppose that shadowy, secretive operation that involved selling arms to Iran to free hostages and then illegally diverting the profits to fund the Contra rebels in Nicaragua.
What specifically was his objection?
Well, his objections were multifaceted and principled. First, he argued it undermined the fundamental U.S. policy against negotiating with terrorists. He saw it setting a disastrous precedent.
And second, he opposed the secrecy.
The secrecy and the rogue operations run by the National Security Council staff people like Oliver North because it circumvented legitimate diplomatic channels and totally undermined the State Department. He maintained a position of moral and political clarity against secret arms sales. He was a much-needed, if often ignored, counterweight within that administration.
Finally, let's briefly touch on his diplomacy in the Middle East and China. Regarding China, he inherited the sticky issue of Taiwan arms sales.
He did. This was a complex diplomatic negotiation that culminated in the August 1982 joint communique with the People's Republic of China. The U.S. agreed to gradually limit its arms sales to Taiwan.
But only in exchange for China agreeing to seek a peaceful solution to the Taiwan question.
It was a challenging high-wire act, trying to maintain relations with the PRC while adhering to U.S. security obligations to Taiwan.
In the Middle East, he was thrust into action following the devastating 1983 Beirut Marine Barracks bombing.
He engaged in intense shuttle diplomacy. He negotiated an agreement between Israel and Lebanon, and despite some severe challenges, including a subsequent contravention of the initial settlement by Lebanon, he managed to convince Israel to begin a partial troop withdrawal in 1985.
And he made a major final move regarding the Palestinian conflict toward the end of his tenure.
Yes. Following 6 months of intense shuttle diplomacy during the First Intifada in 1988, Shultz convinced the administration to establish a diplomatic dialogue with the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO.
And that was a significant strategic shift.
It was huge. It moved away from previous non-recognition, and it was a dialogue that the subsequent administration continued. Shultz was always pushing for engagement, but only once he felt the U.S. was negotiating from a position of strength.
Shultz left office in 1989 and entered the final, longest phase of his career, the elder statesman.
He returned to Stanford University's Graduate School of Business to teach international economics and join the prestigious Hoover Institution, but he did not retire quietly.
No, he became a politically unpredictable, iconoclastic voice, often challenging the core tenets of the Republican Party he had served for decades.
While his initial return to public life reflected his continued standing within the Republican establishment, he was an informal advisor for George W. Bush's campaign in 2000.
And served as a senior member of the Vulcans policy group, working alongside figures like Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, and Paul Wolfowitz.
Right. And our sources suggest he was integral to that group. Some analysts even called him the father of the Bush Doctrine.
So what specific role did he play in shaping the foreign policy thinking of that era?
Well, the Bush Doctrine centered on the idea of preemption and aggressive democracy promotion. Shultz had long advocated for a robust use of American power, and his expertise in dealing with difficult regimes was invaluable to the Vulcans. He publicly and forcefully defended the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
He wrote in support of military action months before the war began.
He did, making the case for intervention alongside other establishment figures. So initially, he was firmly tied to that aggressive foreign policy consensus.
But then, the iconoclast streak emerged. It made him a fascinatingly contradictory figure in his final years.
He started publicly challenging long-held conservative positions, often surprising and sometimes angering his former allies.
And the most dramatic example of this pivot is his comprehensive shift on drug policy.
It's a huge shift. Shultz, the Cold War hawk, publicly called the decades-long war on drugs a total failure.
Not only did he call it a failure, but in 1998, he signed a highly publicized New York Times advertisement arguing the global war on drugs was causing more social harm through violence, corruption, incarceration than drug abuse itself.
It was a complete rejection of the traditional law and order Republican stance. By 2011, he formalized this position by joining the Global Commission on Drug Policy, advocating for a pivot toward a public health and harm reduction approach instead of criminalization.
He used his expertise in public policy and his commitment to efficiency straight out of the Chicago School playbook to critique the war on drugs as a catastrophic policy failure that had wasted trillions of dollars for zero measurable return.
And he showed a similar willingness to discard outdated foreign policy dogma, specifically regarding Cuba.
Right. In a 2008 interview, he called the U.S. embargo against Cuba ridiculous in the post-Soviet world.
And think about that perspective. This is the man who engineered the end of the Cold War. He clearly recognized that the justifications for certain policies, like maintaining a Cold War-era embargo decades after the Soviet Union collapsed, had just evaporated. He strongly favored engagement over sanctions.
This theme of recognizing existential risk and finding practical evidence-based solutions led him to become a powerful, late-career advocate for nuclear arms control.
He maintained that nuclear weapons were ones we wouldn't use. He saw them primarily as a catastrophic risk factor rather than a strategic deterrent. He was intensely focused on the danger of nuclear terrorism and accidental war.
And the pinnacle of this advocacy came in 2008.
It did. That's when he co-authored a truly pivotal op-ed in the Wall Street Journal.
And who did he write this piece with?
He co-authored it with three other policy titans. Former Secretary of Defense William Perry, fellow former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and former Senator Sam Nunn.
Four giants of the American security establishment, many of whom were considered hawkish, united in calling for a world free of nuclear weapons.
That collaboration just shows the weight of their conviction. It was incredibly influential. It led directly to the creation of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a global nonprofit dedicated to reducing global nuclear and biological threats.
It showed that, regardless of party, experience in the deepest recesses of government can force a necessary reckoning with the biggest risks.
I think so.
But perhaps his most profound and often politically difficult advocacy in later life concerned climate change. He urged conservatives to adopt a market-based solution.
This is a perfect full circle back to his Chicago roots. Schultz saw anthropogenic climate change as a clear and present risk, but he insisted the solution must be economically sound and adhere to free market principles.
His answer was the revenue-neutral carbon tax.
Or carbon fee and dividend program, as it's often called.
Can you break down what makes this specific policy proposal appealing to a staunch conservative like Schultz?
The structure is crucial. You impose a fee or a tax on carbon dioxide emissions at the source, the oil well, the mine, or the import point. But crucially, the policy is revenue neutral. All the funds collected are rebated directly back to the American taxpayers.
Either through direct checks or tax cuts.
Exactly. So the goal isn't increasing the size of government, but changing consumer behavior through pricing signals.
It appeals to conservatives because it eliminates the need for complex, heavy-handed regulatory mandates.
Exactly. The myriad rules imposed by the EPA, for example, it's economically efficient, transparent, and it uses the power of the market, the pricing mechanism, to solve the problem. Schultz argued this plan would benefit all Americans by eliminating the need for costly energy subsidies while promoting a level playing field for energy producers.
And he didn't just advocate this theory. He made sure it became a conservative political proposal.
He did. In 2017, he co-founded the Climate Leadership Council with other influential Republican elder statesmen like James Baker and Henry Paulson. They explicitly urged conservatives to adopt this market-based solution. It was Schultz leveraging his lifelong conservative pro-business credentials to address what had become a deeply partisan issue.
Arguing that climate change policy shouldn't be about ideology, but about the most efficient outcome.
Exactly.
Now, we must make a difficult transition. We move from the triumphs of global policy, diplomacy, and principled progressive conservatism to a localized, intensely personal corporate drama that, frankly, tarnished his legacy.
The Theranos scandal.
The Theranos scandal.
This period feels almost fictional given his career trajectory. Schultz, the former four-time cabinet member, served on the board of directors of Theranos from 2011 to 2015.
A health technology company notorious for claiming revolutionary blood testing technology that was, in reality, completely fraudulent.
And he didn't just quietly sit on the board. He used his immense and hard-won prestige, the trust earned in the White House and the State Department, to aggressively promote the founder, Elizabeth Holmes.
He publicly lauded her at major forums like the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. He was essentially validating her and her technology to the world.
He was instrumental in recruiting other high-profile figures. Kissinger, Perry, Nunn to the board, lending the startup an air of legitimacy that helped it raise hundreds of millions from investors.
The tragedy here is the irony. The man who championed transparency, free markets, and the dismantling of Cold War secrecy
was blinded by the myth of Silicon Valley disruption and became the chief validator for a massive fraud based on total secrecy and deception.
And the scandal turned acutely personal because of his own family. His grandson, Tyler Schultz.
Yes. Tyler Schultz, a Stanford biology graduate, actually worked at Theranos and quickly realized the company's blood testing practices were dangerous and fraudulent. He became one of the key whistleblowers.
And this created an agonizing public family conflict.
It did. George Schultz, for reasons that may have included pride, loyalty to Holmes, or simple misjudgment, initially refused to believe his grandson.
The sources indicate he pressured Tyler, the scientist, to keep quiet about the dangers he observed, placing the reputation of the company above the pursuit of truth.
It's heartbreaking. And this leads to the moment of maximum drama and personal betrayal. Tyler eventually contacted Wall Street Journal reporter John Kerry Rue to expose the fraud.
Knowing the expose was coming, Theranos' attorneys attempted to use the grandfather to silence the grandson.
Tyler recounted going to George Shultz's home to discuss the allegations, only to be surprised by the presence of high-powered company attorneys.
So he's confronting his own grandson with company lawyers present.
At his own house. It's an unbelievable scene. They pressured Tyler to sign a document retracting his claims.
And Tyler recalled his grandfather adding personal pressure, saying things like, "Your career would be ruined if Carrie Rue's article comes out."
It was a moment where corporate loyalty just momentarily severed the family tie. Tyler courageously refused to sign, but the subsequent battle involved staggering personal cost.
Tyler and his parents spent nearly $500,000 in legal fees fighting Theranos' accusations.
They had to sell their house to raise the funds necessary to defend themselves against the company their own patriarch had championed.
The sources confirm Shultz eventually moved to a non-technical board of counselors, which was quietly retired in 2016, just before the company shut down in 2018.
But the final necessary chapter of this story is the reconciliation.
It is a moving moment of public humility.
Yeah.
In 2019, Shultz released a public statement that validated his grandson.
He praised Tyler for not shrinking from what he saw as his responsibility to the truth and patient safety, even when he felt personally threatened and believed that I had placed allegiance to the company over allegiance to higher values in our family.
That is a remarkable admission from a man who had only ever known success and high command. A public acknowledgement of his lapse in judgment and a powerful final lesson.
That the pursuit of truth and patient safety must always supersede corporate loyalty or personal pride.
George Shultz continued his work at the Hoover Institution as a distinguished fellow until his final days, maintaining his commitment to economic and foreign policy thinking.
He also served on numerous corporate and nonprofit boards, Battelle, Charles Schwab, Gilead Sciences, reflecting his lasting influence across multiple sectors.
His long, consequential, and often dramatic life came to an end on February 6, 2021, at age 100, at his home in Stanford, California.
His passing prompted widespread reflection across the political spectrum. President Joe Biden's reaction really captured the essence of Shultz's enduring reputation as a statesman.
He said Shultz was a gentleman of honor and ideas, dedicated to public service and respectful debate. I regret that, as president, I will not be able to benefit from his wisdom, as have so many of my predecessors.
He certainly accumulated the honors to match his career's extraordinary reach. The Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1989, the Seoul Peace Prize in 1992, and numerous international honors and honorary degrees from universities worldwide. He was a force who demonstrated the sheer power of expertise and intellectual conviction when applied to the machinery of government.
So we have traced the unparalleled trajectory of George Shultz, a decorated WWII Marine, a dean at the University of Chicago, deeply influenced by the uncompromising tenets of free market philosophy.
He was the key figure in the Nixon administration who simultaneously managed the U.S. economy, enforced the first federal racial quotas through the Philadelphia Plan, and oversaw the dismantling of the Bretton Woods global financial system.
And then, as Secretary of State under Reagan, he used a strategy of strength coupled with engagement to engineer the Soviet thaw.
What's truly fascinating is how his career demonstrates the absolute seamless interconnectedness of global finance and diplomacy. He moved between these worlds with genuine mastery,
recognizing that economic health and security are inseparable.
He did, and he applied intellectual convictions, whether free markets, nuclear control, or a carbon tax as instruments of global strategy, often placing those beliefs above pure political calculation.
And that brings us back to the unexpected and highly complex advocacy of his later years. Shultz, a lifelong Republican elder statesman, the man who helped create the modern conservative foreign policy consensus, ended his career by strongly advocating for aggressive action on climate change.
Via a revenue-neutral carbon tax and for drug policy reform through a public health lens.
This raises an important question for you, the listener, to carry forward.
If a statesman with such deeply conservative economic and foreign policy roots can champion these causes, challenging the anti-tax orthodoxy and the failed war on drugs to address massive global threats, what assumptions about political identity should you be questioning when considering future policy solutions?
Shultz's final iconoclastic years suggest that the biggest threats require radical, evidence-based solutions, regardless of which side of the political aisle typically champions them.
Does profound experience and expertise ultimately transcend partisan lines, forcing policy thinkers to adopt the most effective tools available?
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.